Grab your Bibles and open them, please, to Hebrews chapter 2. We're going to read through this chapter. It's been a while since we visited it, and we're going to look at just the last two verses of Hebrews chapter 2. Read the whole thing, but I'll be speaking just on the last two verses. Hebrews chapter 2 begins with a warning, and I believe it is a warning to believers, as well as to non-believers as well. Hebrews chapter 2, it's either in your Bibles or it's up on the screen. We're going to start reading it. Therefore, we must give the more earnest heed to the things we have heard, lest we drift away. And there is a danger of that. For if the word was spoken through angels proved steadfast, and every transgression and disobedience received a just reward, how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation, which at the first began to be spoken by the Lord and was confirmed to us by those who heard him? God also bearing witness both with signs and wonders, with various miracles and the gifts of the Holy Spirit according to his own will. For he has not put the world to come, of which we speak, in subjection to angels, but one testified in a certain place, saying, what is man that you are mindful of him, or the Son of Man that you take care of him? You have made him a little lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor and set him over the works of your hands. You have put all things in subjection under his feet. For in that he put all in subjection under him, he left nothing that is not put under him. But now we don't see all things put under him, but we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he, by the grace of God, might taste death for everyone. For it was fitting for him, from whom are all things and by whom all things, in bringing many sons to glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through suffering. For both he who sanctifies and those who are being sanctified are all of one. For which reason he is not ashamed to call us brethren, saying, I will declare your name to my brethren. In the midst of the assembly will I sing praise to you. And again, I will put my trust in him. And again, here am I and the children whom God has given me. Inasmuch then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, he himself likewise shared in the same, that through death he might destroy him who had the power of death, that is the devil, and release those who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. For indeed he does not give aid to angels, but he does give aid to the seed of Abraham. Therefore, in all things he had to be made like his brethren, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in the things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For in that he himself has suffered being tempted, he is able to aid those who are tempted. There are many things in the Bible that surprises me. For example, we'll see it in the not-too-distant future. In Hebrews chapter 11, we have what's called, often called, the Hall of Faith. And I'm surprised that Rahab the prostitute and Samson are listed in the Hall of Faith. That's rather surprising to me. It's also, by the way, kind of as a sidebar, good evidence that the content of the Bible did not originate from man. Because if you're living in the first century when this was written, and you put in there, in the Hall of Faith, a woman, which again, Christianity is the only religion that has elevated the role of woman. So to put in, first of all, a woman as a hero of the faith is not going to do well for the cause which you're trying to convince people to believe in, and that she was a prostitute, that's going to be counterproductive. And then also Samson. When you think of Samson, you usually think of Samson and Yeah, so again, just kind of a corollary proof that this was not originated with man, because man wouldn't have done it, because it would have been counterproductive to say, embrace this religion whose heroes are a prostitute and Samson. Kind of counterintuitive there. In chapter 1, as we worked through this several weeks ago, we heard, or we read, or it was developed how Jesus was better than angels. And yes, angels are a fascinating subject, but we should not give all of our time or energy to angels, because Christ is better than the angels. So much more time and study and fascination should be with Christ. Chapter 2 begins with kind of a warning. You need to pay close attention. You need to pay more close attention than maybe the Old Testament saints did to what you have heard. And then as we go a little bit further, the end of chapter 2 to me is just surprising. There's no way you can get around it. How many of you have an old King James Bible? Some of you have the old King James Bible, and in that word there in verse 17, it behooves him. Some of you who have the newer translations, it has the idea, he had to be. And that's why on the title of your outline, which is in your bulletin, it's kind of an expanded outline. It'll help us go through the material a little more quickly. God's obligation? Question mark, exclamation point. He had to be. I didn't know God was obligated for anything. Like, since when did God have to do anything? And it just kind of surprises me where it says there in verse 17, therefore in all things he had to be. This was something he must do. And to me, that just kind of surprises me. And we'll develop that here in just a minute. As you see there on that double-sided outline there, number one, let's look at God's obligation. Now again, as we get to Philippians 2, remember that any obligation or limitation that God has been self-imposed. Philippians 2 says that he humbled himself. Remember when he was going before the crucifixion in that whole last couple of days, he says, listen, you are not taking my life. I am giving my life. I lay down my life for the sheep. So again, we have to qualify that, and it's kind of hard to understand that whole kenosis theory, which they call it in Philippians 2, how that all works out, but God willingly limited himself. For example, he was and has always been, up until B.C. 383, within that time period, he was always everywhere present at all times in his totality, and then when he took on the form of a human being, he was just like you. We could only be in one place at one time. And he limited that ability. And so too with this obligation. This was an obligation that he willingly took on himself. And it was truly an obligation. In Matthew 18, remember the story of the king with the debtors? And the king says, pay me what you owe me. And then the servant went out and found the other servant and says, you pay me what you owe me. It's the exact same word, where he had to be, or it behooved him, or he owed it to us to become like his brethren. Also, as you see there in your notes, in Romans 13, it says, we are to owe no man nothing but love. There's a debt that we have to one another, the one debt that should never, ever be paid off, and that is our love for one another. Well, that same debt is what God, the Son, willingly took on himself. And then in Luke 17, there's a man who had to go do his duty. He was responsible to go do the task that his boss or his owner had told him to do, and he had to do it. Jesus, again, having undertaken the work of redemption, John 3:16, he did it voluntarily, as I mentioned there in John 10. I'm laying down my life for the sheep. No one's taking it. I am God. But being God, I can give up my life. But he then was under obligation to be properly equipped for the priestly service and for the sacrifice. And that's something that we can maybe discuss a little bit in growth groups. But Christ, had to become a man with a physical body just like ours. Capital A, he had to be made in the likeness of man, the incarnation. Kind of interesting, as it says there, he had to be made like a man there in verse 17. Like, Jesus used this in Matthew chapter 6, where he says to the disciples, I do not want you to be like the Gentiles. Don't be like them. Here, he's using it in a positive way, where Jesus had to be like humanity. Humanity. So, and this is something that's just, again, kind of exciting, because Jesus, as we see there in Philippians 2:7, he came in the form and the fashion and the likeness of man, okay? But then we will one day resemble him in eternity, as 1 John says, we shall see him and we shall be like him. So it kind of comes maybe like in a full circle. We have man, and then we have God, and then we have the God-man, and then we're going to be like God-man in our glorified bodies. And that's kind of a fun thing to think about. He had to be made like a man with the suffering. His body got tired. His body got hungry. A body that got injured. He felt the pain. It bled. It hurt. His body was just like ours in every single way. He had the senses of the hearing, the seeing, the smelling, the tasting, and the touching. His body was 100% man. And again, this is where the theologians and even I sometimes have a struggle. But he was 100% man, but he was also 100% God. And somehow those two totalities merged into one body in that incarnation, which has only happened one time in all of history. But he was obligated to be like us in every way, shape, and form. His purpose is stated, as you see there in verse 17 as well. Why? It says there, therefore, in all things, he had to be like his brethren. And then again, that word that, it could also be translated in order that, with the resulting condition. It's kind of introducing a clause of purpose. He had to be made like his brethren in order that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in all things pertaining to God. Notice again the wording there in your translation there in verse 17, that he might be, kind of the idea of a future tense. So when he's talking about the life of Christ, it refers to the fact that Christ's priesthood was not fully inaugurated until after he went to heaven. Because in heaven, then, he's standing at the right hand of God, interceding for us on our behalf. Merciful and faithful, I think they're parallel. Although some, as I was studying some of the various commentaries, some were saying that you have to first be merciful in order to be faithful. Because some of the high priests weren't very caring. They were kind of hard and callous, and they weren't being very faithful because it was just a job that they just had to get through. But a person who was merciful was then also more faithful. Obviously, that was not the case here in God's life. He was truly a very merciful. Again, Matthew 11:28 just rings in my ears. Come unto me, all you are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. At the end of his life, he's climbing up on the hill and he's looking over Jerusalem, and his heart is breaking. He's just saying, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. Scogan's translation, didn't have to go this way. It could have went differently, but you didn't want any with me. The things pertaining to God, as the verse continues to go on there in verse 17, he was a merciful and faithful high priest, so that he could be this merciful and faithful high priest in the things pertaining to God. Everything that is involved in the function of a high priest, he was merciful and faithful in that. And then as we read a little bit more in verse 17, he says, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. And let me just read again what I've put down, and you have a shortened form of it there in your outline. But propitiation, it's that atoning work of Christ on the cross through which he paid the penalty demanded by God because of man's sin. Now again, we have to step back just for a minute and remember that God is a holy God. God cannot stand sin in any way, shape, or form. God, as Psalm 7:11 says, God is angry at the wicked every day. There is an anger that God has against sin that is absolutely frightening. It is a very sad, horrific thought. Well, somehow, that anger had to be taken away. And that was this idea of propitiation. So, Jesus' death on the cross then set mankind free from sin and death. This particular word in our Bibles is an old English word coming from a Greek word, which means to appease. So propitiation expresses the idea that Jesus died on the cross to pay the price for sin that a holy God demanded on man as a sinner. Christ was a sacrifice that turned away the wrath of God. That is why I'm glad we sang that last song. Now no condemnation, now I fear. Or as Romans 8:1 says, there is therefore no condemnation to those who are in Christ Jesus. So again, sometimes the question is, God angry at me? And the answer is, well, first of all, it depends upon how you define anger, but in actuality, no. Because the wrath of God was satisfied some 2,000 years ago on the cross at Calvary. Now, God may be maybe not too pleased with your choices, and as Hebrews goes on to say, whom the Lord loves, he chastens to bring you back into the right path that you ought to be walking. But is God angry at you? Well, no, as I've defined it, because that anger was taken care of on the cross of Jesus Christ. Let's move on. Number two, the Son's suffering. Let's say that you are in just a world of hurt, and you can define that hurt any way you want. And sometimes, and I don't know why it is, but sometimes when people really get in a difficult situation, let's just say, for example, Robin's going to Florida next week, visit her father's 85th birthday, surprise birthday party, etc. Let's say the plane crashes and she dies. All right, now, normally, especially for those outside these walls, their first response is to blame God, shake their fist at God, and walk away from God. God, if you loved me, how could a loving God, blah, 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 and they do that and they walk away. Or, how can God know what I'm going through? Because we would try to encourage them. Yeah, but you got to go to God. God is the one who can only really help you through this. And we go, God, what do you mean God? I mean, he's some being, some sort of a spirit being up in the clouds or something up there somewhere. How can he know what I'm going through? But this verse teaches he knows exactly what you're going through. And that is just an amazing concept here. He had to suffer. He had to suffer. The suffering is now in verse 18. And think it through as you see, maybe there a little bit on your outline. How did he suffer? He suffered relational conflict. They were fighting among the disciples. As he's going through his life, remember Jesus was born of Nazareth? You know, as we remember the Luke 2 story, and there was a shepherd in the field, etc. Well, Nazareth was his birthplace. And you remember how people chided him? Scogan, is there anything good that comes out of Nazareth? They're just a bunch of weird, depraved, whacked out people. There's nothing that good's out of. And then they say, is this not the carpenter's son? I mean, who is he to be teaching us the law? He's not a high priest. He doesn't even come from that. I mean, we don't see it, and yet he's just a carpenter's son. He's telling us how to live, and just the constant harassment that he's getting. And you can see again through the listing there, just the harshness of Rome. He was living in that world, and Rome was a very harsh. And then ultimately, there was separation by the Father. He was tempted. And here again, sometimes you and I were tempted. And let's just say something very innocuous. We've got our coffee, okay? And the coffee is screaming in my ears, okay? And life is revolving around coffee. And I don't really think that anybody can really help me because no one really understands my struggle, right? Haven't you heard people say that? And especially, you know, the church and God that's just kind of emotionally crushed. And no one really knows, but God really knows. You know, 40 days He was in the wilderness. And he was very hungry as a human body, a perfectly human body, which means he was perfectly hungry. And yet Satan comes in and tempts him with these stones and says, why don't you turn these into bread? Now Peter, you know, and when he's tempting him to avoid the cross, Jesus says, wait a minute, get behind me, Satan. You know, I am going to go to the cross. In Gethsemane, three times he was tempted to throw in the towel and say, I don't really want to do this because being God and knowing perfectly, this is really going to hurt. So Father, if this cup could pass from me, that would be great. I really don't want to go through this ridicule, being stripped naked and ripped and beaten and scourged and all that stuff and crucified. And he said it three times. Three times. So he really knows what it's like to be tempted. Christ suffered so that he can honestly and perfectly say, you know what? I've been there and I've done that. And I know exactly what you're going through. But you know the difference between you and me? Well, God and you. He got through it perfectly, sinlessly, without sin. And God is able then to help us. And then again, depending upon what your translation has there in verse 18, it says that he is able to aid. Some may have the word succor. Regardless what it is, it's this idea that God is able to help. And this is where it strikes right to the heart of the matter, because again, I was talking to some of our shut-ins this week, and some of them are really, really having a very, very difficult time physically. And unfortunately, with the diagnosis and the limitations of our medical science, they're not going to get better, and they're just kind of slowly waiting to die. And you go to them and you ask them, and I have kind of an idea of what they're struggling with physically, and I talk to them spiritually and emotionally, and I have kind of an idea of what they're going through, but what's my ability to help? About zero, because I ask, you know, can we bring some meals over? Well, we got that taken care of. Can we send some people from the church to help clean? Oh, I got a lady coming in. You need ride to the doctors? No, pretty much the kids take care of that, or Bucks County Transit does that. There's really not much we can do, and there's really not much I can do. But you know the difference between me and God is? God is able to help you. He can really, really help you. And again, God's power is more than just knowing, yeah, I know what you're going through, but yes, I can help you. And it's kind of interesting, this word able to help or to succor, it's a compound word. And it has, the first idea is to cry. The second part of the word is to run. Now, moms, you can probably appreciate this. If your child was in pain and is crying, Mom, help me, what would you do? It would be like that cliche, feet don't fail me now. And you're running as fast as you could. You're dropping everything to go help your child. Or even for you husbands, if your wife, she says, Dan, come here, I need your help. Well, hon, as soon as the commercial comes, I'll be over there. Just a minute, hon, I just got to finish. It's almost to halftime. No, man, we drop and run. This is the same idea, and this is the same word for God. So here we are in our moment of struggle, and here we are in our moment of temptation. And when we cry out to God, we shouldn't be in our mind thinking, well, he's a really busy God, and when he gets time, he's finally going to come around and help me. It's like before you can finish that thought, before the diaphragm is pushing the air over your folds, he's on the run. He is right there to help you. Which again is important, because when you and I are struggling with temptation, there's not a lot of time that goes by between the struggle and either the rejecting or the giving in. And when I'm struggling with my coffee, it's not like, okay, God, in a half hour you can show up and help me or not. It's like, God, the old flesh is craving, and I can smell it, and I'm driving by Dunkin' Donuts, and God, you got to help me or I'm pulling in. Well, he's right there. He's right there instantaneously. And then he goes on in the bottom of verse 18, he says, to help those who are tempted. Going back up to the context of Hebrews, these are probably now second generation Christians. And this is where it kind of gets scary, because even in our parenting skills, as we've seen it played out, for Robin and I, first generation, it is a conviction. But now my son and daughter, it's more of an inheritance. You know why Eric and Stephanie came to church all those years? Because they had to. You want to live in my house, you come to church. It's just that simple. You want to go live with grandma, grandpa, or whatever, help yourself. But when you're in my house, you're coming to church. So the second generation is an inheritance. And what we have to do as parents is to get that second generation to make it a conviction. Or the fourth gen or the third generation, it just becomes a convenience. Well, you know, it's kind of a yucky day outside today. It's cold and windy and not much else to do, so I'll come to church. But next Sunday, when it's nice and warm, I hear Tyler State Park calling. And we're going to take the dog Sunday afternoon or morning, and we're just going to go for a nice walk, play in the creek a little bit. We're going to have a good time. And then by the time you get to the fourth generation, they want nothing to do with it. This is what's going on here in the book of Hebrews. They're second generation Christians. And they're saying, why should I continue suffering the social ostracization? Why should I continue to struggle and have to go through all just being of what's involved in a Christian? They're making fun of me. They're persecuting me. You know, I can't even live in Jerusalem. These people to whom this letter was written to were probably not living in Jerusalem. They've been kicked out of their country. And it's like, why can't we just go back to the old ways? Let's just go back to the good old days and embrace Old Testament Judaism, and things could be a lot better than being a follower of the way. These Christians, who were first called Christians in Antioch, we don't really need to do this, do we? And I think that's part of that temptation there. They were just having a difficult time. And that's why he warns them in the beginning of this chapter, in chapter 2, verse 2, we must pay more closer attention lest we drift away. Let me just again appreciate what God has done for us here by reading a kind of a prolonged quote from John Calvin. I'll summarize it this way in case I lose you in the quote. God the Son has perfect knowledge of everything, right? There's absolutely nothing that God does not know. More of the technical definition is God knows everything, past, present, future, actual or possible, and he knows it simultaneously in one simple act. So as we read here verses 17 and 18, where he said he had to be like man, he had to suffer, he had to be tempted. Do you really know why he had to do that? It wasn't for his benefit, but it was for our benefit, so that we, fickle faith, could put more faith in him. Because he knows everything. He didn't have to do this, but he did it for us. So here's what John Calvin said. John Calvin lived, I don't know, about 1,000 or so years ago. He says, the Son of God had no need of experience that he might know the emotions of mercy. But we could not be persuaded that he is merciful and ready to help had he not become acquainted by experience with our miseries. And in a way, that's kind of a shame on us. But do you appreciate what he did? Do you appreciate what he went through? So at a moment's notice, if you call him, he is able to help. Drop of a hat, he's running there to help you, and he can help. I can't. I can point you to Jesus. I can point you to obedience of his word. I can gather the resources of our church, but I really can't do much. But God is there to help you. So some of our questions as we kind of close up here is, Christ allowed himself to suffer so that he'd be willing to help you. And again, it's the foolishness of sin that when we need help in times of suffering, we often turn our back on God. You know, and I hear this a lot. I said, man, are you reading the Bible? Well, you know, it's just really hard to read, and I'm just really not in a good spot right now. I'm really struggling a lot right now, and I'm just, no, I'm not reading the Bible. Go to the Psalms. Read Psalm 22. You'll find the same man there in Psalm 22 shaking his fist at God saying, why have you forsaken me? But Psalm 22 doesn't end up with a shaken fist. It ends up with more of an open heart. So read Psalm 22 and read between the lines and you can get to that same place. Well, yeah, but you know, I'm just in a bad spot right now. You know, it's just really hard to understand. You know what I'm saying? And we need to just allow him to help us in our relational struggles. Man, I tell you, as we just see more of the world, I'm just increasingly not having any more of a love relationship with this world. I've always said it, kind of kidding, I'm very much against tattoos, but if I was going to get a tattoo, it'd be do not resuscitate right here. So when they rip my shirt open, okay, don't do it. I might do that. I'll tell you, the world is just... the world, but when you look at the world around us, there is so much heartache, there's so much suffering, there's so much evil and wickedness. God, take us home. Now would be good. Yesterday might have been better. But will you allow him, though, to help you in your emotional struggles, the relational struggles? And there are so many struggles out there, the physical struggles. I can't believe I hurt my shoulder back in September. It still hurts. Like, it is the craziest thing to get my left arm straight up over my head. It hurts. And it's like, you got to be kidding me. And I am just getting a precursor of what some of you are living with every day. So with the physical struggles, are we allowing him to help us? The heart, the spiritual struggles, is he? Are we allowing him to help us? He is able. Our God is mighty to save. He is there at a moment's notice. In the relationship struggles, in the emotional struggles, in the physical struggles, in the heart spiritual struggles, are you allowing him to help you? He did it for you. He's there to help you. He can do it if you will but let him.